This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, views of our callers, and if you're out there across America, we'd love to hear from you. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295, but please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line my good friend Ralph Epperson, and I've known Ralph for, well, probably close to 15 years now, give or take a year or so, and he's always been certainly one of my favorite commentators. He's written a number of books, The Unseen Hand, The New World Order. He wrote that even 5 years before Bush was talking about the New World Order. He wrote a book certainly on the secret goal of Masonry, and we'll be talking more about that tonight. But you really can't understand anything going on in America, or many things going on in America, unless you understand the influence of Freemasonry, because that is, of course, Ralph Epperson's major field of study. You can't understand, for instance, why the Senate would not impeach Bill Clinton. certainly the members of the House of Representatives, 10 of them had steered the impeachment through the House, and certainly it had passed the House this first time this had happened, and I don't know how many years going back, I suppose, to the time of Andrew Jackson. But, of course, they take the petition, the charges to the Senate, and who is leading the Senate but Trent Lott, who happens to be a 33rd-degree Mason, and, of course, she lets them know, in no uncertain terms, that there's no way Bill Clinton is going to be impeached. He doesn't bother to tell them that he's a Mason and that Bill Clinton is the highest-ranking demolé, which is the club for Masonic boys in our country, and there's no way that he would could allow, possibly, an impeachment of somebody related to Masonry. The same story with Della Beckwith, the assassination of Medgar Evers, and of course he was a Mason, and they couldn't ever get a conviction in a trial because, of course, his Masonic ties, and all he had to do was give a sign, a symbol, and the jurors would, of course, have to, because of their blood oaths that they've sworn, have to turn him loose. And apparently, Ralph was saying that one of the people who swore that he was several hundred miles away at the time of the shooting was a Mason, giving him an alibi, because Masons will lie to protect a fellow Mason. And, of course, the reason that they've taken the Ten Commandments out of our schools, they've taken God and prayer out of our schools, is because the Masons control the Supreme Court in majorities of 5-4 to 8-1 from 1941 to 1971. And the fact that you've never heard most of these things discussed any other place simply reflects the degree of control over the medium, over our religious leaders, over our educational system that exists today, and over what the American people think. Ralph, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, Dr. Stan, I can assure you it's my pleasure. I always enjoy doing your programs.
Well, of course, now you've been studying Masonry for how long?
Well, I started with my first book in 1984, so it's, 19 years now. I've read all of their literature, all the key literature. I've read like 14 of their key writers, 50-some of their books. I've read them. I personally have read them, and I've used them in the documentation for my book. I don't quote things that are written by some guy that's not a Mason or some critic. I used the Masonic literature to conclude, as I did in my third book, that the title says, Masonry does have a true purpose, as they point out in the 30th degree, it is the destruction of Christianity. And I know that's hard to believe, but that's in their own literature. I found it. I documented it.
All right, fine. And of course, Ralph is very, very reliable. In fact, he offers a free book. It's a loose leaf book, but it's one of the finest things I've seen. And he offers that to anybody who gives him a call and just asks for it. Why don't we just start out telling people how they can get in touch with you and get that book, which is a book review of Morals and Dogma. Now, for our listeners out there, Morals and Dogma is the book that was given to all Masons, I think, at the 14th degree up until about 1974. Unfortunately, our educational system has dumbed people down so much that the average Mason today cannot read Morals and Dogma, but they could read it before, and of course this was really the story of what Masonry was really all about. But of course you have to study it, you have to contemplate, you have to think about it, because of course the truth is that they hide the truth from most Masons. In fact, in that book they tell about how they deceive most Masons, and most Masons are good people, but of course they will never know the truth of this organization that they've sworn these horrible oaths to, because, of course, Albert Pike makes it very clear they're not fit, they're not intelligent enough to know the secrets are reserved for the adepts and the princes of Masonry. So what's the title of your book? How can people get it?
Yeah, it's a 72-page booklet called A Review of Morals and Dogma, as you pointed out, their number one book, written by Albert Pike. Just before we get into the rest of the book thing, let me explain this. There's a statue of Albert Pike in Washington, D.C., put there by the 33rd Degree Council. I saw it with my own eyes, took pictures of it, and it's included in a video that I made about the Masonic Lodge. It says at the plaque, on the plaque at the base of the statue, that Albert Pike was the leader of the worldwide Masonic movement. That's called the number one Mason of all time. He was the director from 1859 until he died in 1891. That's 32 years or something like that. So this man is the official writer for the Masonic Lodge, and he wrote the number one book, as you carefully pointed out, called Morals and Dogma. So the book is very hard to read. I wrote it, and very hard to find, by the way. If you can't get a used copy, you might not be able to get a copy from your Masonic friend. But I wrote a review of it. It's free, no cost, no obligation. I don't follow up on it, I do nothing. But all you got to do is call me, and I have an 800 number, which means I even pay for the call. So there's no cost to you, no postage, no follow-up. Just send you the book, you read it, and if you want to get back to me, the booklet will tell you how.
All right, fine. Well, I recommend the book. It's very, very revealing. And besides that, the price is right. Now, of course, you make your claim. What's the title of your third book?
Third book is called Masonry, Conspiracy Against Christianity.
Masonry, Conspiracy Against Christianity. Now, we carry all of Ralph's books. You can get those from us if you'd like to. We think they're important, but I think the third one is the most important one. Why did the Masonic judges who controlled the Supreme Court in 1962 and take a prayer out of our school and God out of our schools? Why? Because their job was to destroy the Christian foundation of this country. They knew what would happen when we, of course, took God and prayer out of our schools. We would, of course, go into a chaotic situation. We would have no moral foundation for our society. And the Supreme Court held that we should not post the Ten Commandments because, in their own words, they would do no good unless they were read, and if they were read, the children might meditate upon them, and if they were to meditate upon them, they might obey them, and, of course, that would be a violation of the wall of separation between church and state. In other words, if our children didn't kill and commit adultery and steal, why, that would be a violation of if they were not to do those things, that would violate the wall of separation between church and state. They wanted to break down this society. Why? Because the true purpose of the secret core, the inner core of Masonry, not the average Mason, but the inner core of Masonry is to create a one world order and a new world religion. A pagan religion worshiping the God that they worship, the great architect of the universe, but not the God of the Bible. Ralph, would you like to, of course, to go over this idea that Masonry is a fraternity within a fraternity? Because that's so important to understand. A lot of our listeners probably have somebody who's been a Mason in their family, or they know somebody, and a lot of these are good people. So how do you explain that?
Well, if I may, Stan, before I do that, let me get, if I may, get my 800 number, which is
okay, fine.
And that means that if you want a copy of this review, it's free, no cost, give me a call. You can start calling now. If the line's busy, just try again. It's 800, please write this down, 422-3888. 800-422-3888. Now, let's talk about the Masonic Lodge. If I may, Stan, can I lay down a little foundation work to show what the Masonic Lodge consists of? So they'll understand when we say a 33rd degree Mason, 32nd, whatever. Is that fair?
Right ahead.
Okay, the average Mason, the first Mason, joins what they call the Blue Lodge, and there's 3 degrees, first, second, and third. He can stop there if he chooses, and he'll be a Blue Lodge member, a Mason for the rest of his life, as long as he wants. Now, then he can go on, if he chooses to go on, into 2 different fraternal organizations, both called Masonic. One's called the York Rite, Y-O-R-K, York, and the second's called the Scottish Rite. The York Rite has 10 more degrees for a total of 13, 3 plus 10, and the Scottish Rite has a total of 32, the 3 in the Blue Lodge, plus 29 more. And then on top of both organizations is the 33rd. That is an honorary degree. You can earn the others by your own choice. If you wish to go on or not, that's up to you. But the 33rd is honorary. And the 33rd degree Mason, in their 33rd degree in their own writings, is the one that controls, I believe, the worldwide Masonic movement. That means the Washington, D.C. group runs all Masons worldwide. Now, so that you can understand, when we say a 33rd, like we're going to talk about here in a few seconds, these men are the top members of the Masonic Lodge, and I believe, since there are 2 layers, the Masons admit this, there are 2 layers inside the Lodge. The second layer is this 33rd degree, or at least those who understand the secret, or if you will, even the, quote, true purpose, unquote. Now, on your way to the 32nd, you pass through the 30th degree in the Scottish Rite, and that's where the Mason takes an oath. Now, understand, this is in their own rituals. I've read their rituals. I didn't steal them. I'm not a Mason, never been a Mason. So I got these. I bought them from a Mason selling the books up in Kela, Montana. And anyone can buy the books. I'm not special. I didn't find any unusual way to get the books. But you can read the Masonic rituals. If you want any of these books, get in touch with me. I'll show you how to get them. You can read them yourself. Now, at the 30th degree, the Mason takes an oath to destroy Christianity, Period. That's it. It's that simple. Now, I have to admit, it's not said that way, but in my third book, I show you that you can know that's what it means because you are told to reflect, study, and interpret, and that's what I've done. So the Mason has a true purpose. Albert Pike, who wrote The 30th Degree and All Rituals, admits in another book that at the 30th degree, you learn the, quote, true purpose, unquote, of Masonry. The true purpose of Masonry, the one concealed from the average Mason, is that they're out to destroy Christianity. That's it.
And, of course, the Masonry, according to Mantley P. Hall, who was the greatest Masonic philosopher of all time, at least that's what the Scottish Rite magazine said when he died here in the early 90s. Mantley P. Hall, in his book, The Lectures on Ancient Philosophy, said Masonry is a fraternity within a fraternity, and not a fraternity of good-hearted men having a good time and doing good, but an internal fraternity, an inner fraternity, where, of course, the men study the Ancorum and the Anconorum, which is, of course, the secret and the secret of secrets, or the great secret. And what is the great secret? Well, of course, the light. When you join the Blue Lodge, at each of the first three levels, you were asking, what do you want most? And you say, the light. Of course, you don't know what the light is. Now, you may imagine it's the light of Jesus, but actually what you're actually asking is for Lucifer to come into you, Lucifer, the light bearer. And that's covered on page 321 of Morals and Dogma. So just as when a Christian asked Jesus to come into their life and their life is transformed, as happened to me and I'm sure to many out there in the listening audience, so when you are a Mason and you ask, of course, the light to come into your life, Lucifer or a demon comes to indwell you. And, of course, until you renounce that, why, he will be there throughout all eternity. That's the great tragedy. And people say, well, that's just crazy. I mean, you don't get indwelled by anything. Well, I'll tell you, as a Christian, I know that when the Holy Spirit comes into your life changes. And when, of course, the Lucifer or one of his demons comes into your life, your life changes too. That's why you should never even contemplate even toying with this whole situation. But there's no question this is what it's about. If you want the exact references to where in the Lectures in Ancient Philosophy you can find that, why, you can, of course, go to my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, and we give you that quotation and the source reference, which is why my book is important. Not that it's a great book, nowhere near as good as Ralph's books, but at least it gives you the source. Of course, Ralph's books also have tremendous amount of documentation in them. So basically, what does it say there in the 30th degree, do you recall?
Well, it's just something. They take an oath to avenge tyranny, and then they tell you that there are two forms of tyranny. One is of government, and one is of religion. But they then break down religion into showing you that it's Christianity, because at the 30th degree, they actually see three skulls. And on each one is a different form of ornamentation, meaning a hat or some form. One has got a tiara, one has got a laurel wreath, and the third has a crown. The crown represents government, the tiara represents a victory or the Jacques de Molay, and the third one represents Christianity. And that's what they take an oath to avenge, tyranny. Now, understand this. The average Mason, I want to make this point very clear. The average Mason doesn't probably understand even that when he goes to the 30th degree. You're supposed to study, reflect, and interpret. Those are the words that Albert Pike tells you. And he also goes on to say this, and this is one of the great questions of all time. He calls those who do not see the secret, those brothers, meaning his fellow Masonic brothers, he calls them ignorant. Those are his exact word. So you are supposed to figure it out. And once you figure it out, you know that you've taken an oath to destroy Christianity. Because the third skull represents Christianity. It represents the crucifixion of Jesus. So this is what this is all about, that they're out to destroy Christianity. Now, government operates, this is what they call this church separation, church and state, which is false. In this nation, we followed the Old Testament and the New Testament. The reason we have a constitution is because God told us to create a government, and when we did so, we were to punish those that created these evils. That's why. Now, if you are a Mason, you don't believe that God's got moral absolutes, and that's what they teach. There is no such thing. It's called situation ethics. Each man is to decide for himself that you shall not be punished for crime. Then why should we even have religion? Religion teaches decency, rightness, those things that we should do. Thou shalt and thou shalt not. And that's why they're out to destroy Christianity, because Christianity teaches, as does the Bible, that there are commandments we're supposed to obey. Thou shalt not, thou shalt. And what's wrong with that? What's wrong with saying murder is wrong? Now, I want you to know, in the Masonic literature, and I'll quote it if it's necessary, they have permission to murder. It's given to them by the Masons. It's in their own literature. Now, I'll give you an example, if I may take a minute, Stan. I now have evidence that documented, provable evidence, a copy of a newspaper that Franklin Roosevelt knew about Pearl Harbor and did nothing. And that form of the evidence consists of the front page of the newspaper in Hilo, Hawaii, the Sunday before the Sunday attack on Pearl Harbor of December the 7th. This paper came out on November the 30th, 1941. And the headline reads, Japan may attack this weekend.
Well, you know, that's that goes right along with my September newsletter, because in that I quote from the diary of Secretary of War Simpson on the 25th of November, 5 days before that, when he talks about that day. Of course, he went to the White House, and there was Secretary of State Cordell Hull and Frank Knox, Secretary of the Navy, and George Catlett Marshall, Chief of Staff of the Army, and, of course, I think there was one other person, and himself and the president. And the president said, we may very well be attacked by next Monday. We can expect a surprise attack. The only question is, how are we going to get into the war, get the Japanese to fire the first shot, and do as little damage to ourselves as possible? And, of course, that's exactly what they did. They knew the attack was coming, and we simply give you the sequence of events. And they simply allowed it to take place. Because, of course, had we fired the first shot, the American people would, of course, objected to going to war. Once the Japanese fired the first shot and, of course, killed a certain number of our people, then you could rally the people behind the government. But since Roosevelt was a Mason, he saw nothing wrong with this sort of thing. Because, after all, it was for a greater good. And there were only 3,000 American boys who died there. I think 3,100 and some odd either dead or still missing today, entombed in the Arizona. And if you want to see a copy of that page of the diary, we have it. You give us a call. As for Secretary of War Simpson's diary, I went back to Yale University. I got it. I have it. We'll be right back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is, of course, Ralph Epperson. And, Ralph, I would love to see, I'll tell you what, I'll swap you a copy of Secretary of War Simpson's diary for a copy of that front page of the newspaper.
I will be happy to put it on the list, Dr. Stan. I'll send you the Hilo, Hawaii newspaper.
All right.
You'll see with your own eyes.
And we'll get that page out of the diary of Simpson.
Thank you. I'd love to see that.
Right.
Let me, if I may, Stan, these are two short paragraphs. Each one's two sentences long, one's one. I want to document this. This is in Morals and Dogma, page 833. Now, this is the kind of thing that I do in my review. I cite the page, I cite the book it's in, and then I quote it. This is what it is. This is the reason that Franklin Roosevelt, a Mason, 32nd degree Mason, I've got a picture of him in his Masonic attire, is in Life magazine, so we know he's a Mason. The Masons acknowledge him as being a Mason. He could sit in Pearl Harbor, in Washington, D.C., waiting for word of the attack on Pearl Harbor. He knew about it in advance. Now, how could any moral man do that? Here's the answer. It's in the Masonic literature. Morals and Dogma, page 833. Quote, it is not true to say that one man, however little, must not be sacrificed to another, however great, to a majority or to all men. Now, what is he saying? It's not true to say we shouldn't sacrifice people. It's not true. Now, what is the word? Okay, let's talk about it. We'll talk about the word sacrifice in a minute. That is not only a fallacy, but a most dangerous one. Often, one man and many men must be sacrificed in the ordinary sense of the term. Now, what does the ordinary sense of the term sacrifice mean? It means pushing a virgin into the volcano, She doesn't want to go. She's not, she didn't agree to it. So you can sacrifice people as long as it benefits the cause. So he could sit there and wait for these people at Pearl Harbor to be sacrificed in the ordinary sense of the word. That's ludicrous. That's frightening.
I don't know if you've ever been to Hawaii and seen the Arizona. It's still there. You can just see the top of the mast sticking out of the water. There are 800 boys entombed there. They've never gotten their bodies out. They just left them there. And, of course, they were left there to die. Of course, our planes were all bunched together so they'd be easy targets for the Japanese. And, of course, well, you have to read my news letter, but, of course, we point out that instead of notifying the commanders of Pearl Harbor the attack was coming, General George Captain Marshall could have picked up a telephone when he knew the war was coming and simply called them or used the radio and told them. But he didn't do that. He sent the message by Western Union, and 30 minutes after the attack, when thousands of American boys were wounded or dead, here comes the cablegram announcing that the attack is coming on Pearl Harbor. It's delivered by a boy on a bicycle, the cablegram. So, you know, but of course we have to conceal this from the American people. We can never let the American people know what really happened at Pearl Harbor. Because, of course, they would, they would begin to lose confidence in our leaders, and that's why to this very day, much of the information surrounding what happened at Pearl Harbor, the intercepts, it is still classified 60 years after the fact, 62 years now, why the information is classified, cannot be released, cannot be seen by historians. Why? Because, of course, the American people must never, never learn the truth.
Well, now we know not only that we did it, we now know why he could do it. I can't imagine a man being any moral, decent man sitting in a Washington office of the White House or where he was.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. All right, Dr. Stan, our guest is Ralph Epperson. But you have to understand there are people who look at the world differently than you and I do, Ralph. They march to a different drumbeat. They respond to the sound of a different trumpet. They dream a different dream. They worship a different God, because the God of Masonry is the grand architect of the universe, the great architect of the universe, not the God of the Bible. And until people understand this is a spiritual battle being fought on a political and ideological and cultural battlefield, until we understand the spiritual forces which are not imaginary but which are real, we can't understand what's really going on.
I'd like to, if I may, just cite another thing that we should maybe talk about, Dr. Stan, and that's their belief that the universe was not created. Let's get into that, if we may. The first five words of the Bible are, in the beginning, God created. In the beginning, God created. Albert Pike wrote that to believe that the universe was created is to believe, quote, a monstrous absurdity, unquote. A monstrous absurdity. So the universe has always been here. And by the way, science says that's not true. The universe has not always been. You can prove that scientifically. So Albert Pike, this great Masonic leader, was wrong. W-R-O-N-G, wrong.
But of course, his whole thrust was to discredit and destroy Christianity.
Exactly. Because the Bible says that it was Jesus that created the universe. Now, if that's true, that's why they've got to destroy Christianity. Because they believe... They make this absurd statement, unscientific, not founded on anything except Albert Pike's words, that to believe the universe was not created is to believe a monstrous absurdity. I just had a debate for 2 hours with a Mason on America Online in a private instant message chat, and I brought up the evidence that the universe was. I'm talking about theories. I'm talking about scientific laws that the universe was created. It had to be created because of scientific laws, and he just says, I deny that. I ignore it.
Well, of course, arguing with a Mason, you have to understand he's coming from a different worldview. And until he comes to believe in God, he will continue to adhere to the Masonic beliefs and, of course, their creeds. This is the real problem we face, is that these are many times good people who are drawn into this thing. And, of course, what nobody ever tells them, do you ever mention to them, Ralph, that their own literature says that one day they will stand before the great white throne of judgment? I know they bring that up at Masonic funerals. You will stand before the great white throne of judgment. Have you ever told them what the great white throne of judgment is?
Yes, Dr. Stan, I know. Go ahead, tell us.
It's the judgment of the damned. You read in Revelation. Of course, Christians will stand before the, Jesus Christ, before the, and not before the great white throne of judgment, but we will be judged elsewhere. So anybody who goes to the great white throne of judgment is damned. And of course, people who put this together know exactly what it's all about. They know the Bible. They understand that they're damned, and they're bringing other people into, of course, eternity and hell.
Can we get into this thing about the two quotes by Manly P. Hall about how powerful the Masons are?
Sure, go ahead.
He wrote this. Masonry, this is Manly P. Hall, a 33rd degree Mason, as Dr. Stan just correctly pointed out, when he passed away, I think it was in 1990, he was called the greatest Masonic philosopher of all time, which means a writer, researcher, etc. He said, quote, Masonry is the most powerful organization in the land. The most powerful. Not just a second little small group, the most powerful organization in the land. Then he went on to say, it is an ordainer of kings. Its hand has shaped the destinies of worlds.
Gee, isn't it amazing that the American people have no idea that? I wonder why.
Let me just talk about this. They said there that they ordain kings, but they also unordain kings. I want to get specific here. I want to talk briefly about the John Kennedy assassination in Dallas, Texas. Now, after the assassination, there was an appointment made of Earl Warren as to lead what they called the Warren Commission to study the assassination. Inside the Warren Commission is a photograph called the Aldrin's photograph. I reproduced it in all my videos. It's been in 100 books. It's inside the Warren Commission. You can see it with your own eyes. That photograph shows you, it was taken from across the street looking back at the school book depository. It shows you that Lee Harvey Oswald was not in the sixth floor of the school book depository firing at John Kennedy. He was on the floor of the first floor. You can see him standing in the doorway, Lee Harvey Oswald. Now that means that he could not have been on both the first floor and the sixth floor at the same time. It's an impossibility.
Well, of course, you know, but when you've got Gerald Ford, a Mason, this member of the CFR on the commission, when you've got Earl Warren, a 33rd degree Mason, heading that, you've got Richard Russell, a Mason on the Warren Commission, you have the man directing this, a man named the assistant counsel, Arlen Specter, now Senator Arlen Specter, 33rd degree Mason, little wonder that we did not get the truth about the assassination of an American president. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan here. Our guest this evening is Ralph Epperson, and we probably should have scheduled him for 2 hours, because, of course, when Ralph and I get together, we go on and on and on. But if you're out there in the listening audience calling from the Great Northwest and you'd like, of course, to ask a question, don't hesitate to ask. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Of course, the fact that you're not hearing these things is not being written up in the news media. It simply reflects the degree of control over the news media. The fact that the Masons still kill people who, of course, reveal too much about them. Have you ever had any threats on your life, Ralph?
No, I'll be very honest with you. I've had some very mild threats on America Online, but to be very candid with you, no, I've had none. None whatsoever, except those little things like, you better be careful what you say, Ralph, that kind of thing. Can I say one more thing about the Warren Commission?
You can say whatever you want to, Ralph.
Thank you, Dr. Stan. There's one more name we've got to talk about as being a Mason, and that's J. Edgar Hoover, was a 33rd degree Mason. Now that means that the number one man in the FBI and the number one man leading the Warren Commission both had an agenda. They got to protect the Masonic Lodge, and they did. The Masonic Lodge was directly involved in the assassination. How do we know that? Can I go on to this? You want to talk about
it? Sure, go ahead.
Okay, let's talk about this very briefly. In 1801, the Masons created their first 33rd degree lodge building in Charleston, South Carolina. And the reason they did it in that city was because it was underneath the 33rd degree northern latitude. Now, the 33rd degree northern latitude is the the parallel line to the equator, except 33 degrees up to a, the North Pole would be 90, so it's on its way up to 30, up to 90. It's about a third of the way up. So it's right underneath the 33rd degree northern latitude. That same line goes around the Earth and comes back to Charleston, South Carolina. Now, in Dallas, Texas, the same line goes over there. So Dallas, Texas was selected by the Masons, in my opinion, to be the location of the assassination.
Well, now, can you prove that, though, or is that a supposition?
No, no. It's, well, let's just go with it. Let's keep talking. Let me give you some more evidence about this. The Dallas is under the 33rd. That's a matter of geography. Now, the second part is that Dealey Plaza, the site where John Kennedy was killed, is in this triangular park kind of thing, in right across the street from the school book depository. That park has an obelisk in it. And on the base of the obelisk is a plaque saying that Dealey Plaza was the site of the first fraternal lodge in Texas. Now, the Masons created the state of Texas. Their flag is the Lone Star State. It was designed, according to the Masons, this is not, I'm not making this up, it's in their own literature. The state flag was designed by a Mason. Austin and Houston and Jim Bowie and Davy Crockett and all the men at the Alamo were members of the Masonic Lodge. So Texas is a Masonic state. So he was murdered in the site of the first fraternal lodge, the first Masonic lodge, in my opinion, in Dallas. Now notice one more thing. Notice he was murdered on November the 22nd. Now by coincidence, November is the 11th month of the year, plus the 22 days totals how many? 33. Well, that's not a coincidence because it was on November the 22nd, 1307, that the Pope, I've forgotten his name, it was Felix, issued a papal bull condemning the Knights Templar, which was the group that predated the Masonic Lodge. And the Catholic Church later burnt Jacques de Molay, their leader of the Knights Templar, on Notre Dame Square. They burned him at the stake for heresy and everything else. And now they... Masons take an oath to avenge the murder of Jacques de Molay, so they helped take out the first Catholic president of the United States, John Kennedy.
Well, of course, remember Jacques de Molay was, of course, executed on the Friday the 13th of October. Of course, it was the year 1307, as I remember, something like that. So, yeah, of course, but can you really, can you prove that from any other source?
No, the Masons aren't going to admit it, but then let's just say that they were involved. Now, let's presume that from the evidence of the 33rd degree, the day, the time, by the way, they wanted it to occur at midnight, at noon, right underneath the sun, which would be directly overhead, because that's when the sun is at its strongest. So they didn't have John Kennedy be at the World Trade Center, what was called the Trademark, I guess it was, where John Kennedy was supposed to speak at 12:30. Now what happened was John Kennedy's motorcade was supposed to be in Dealey Plaza at high noon, and unfortunately, this is in the Warren Commission, unfortunately, people kept running out, shaking his hand or stopping or running out in the street, slowing down the motorcade, so they got there about 25 to 30 minutes late. Now that's, so they wanted him to be murdered under the sun, which is the symbol of the Masonic Lodge, the symbol of their great worshipful master. It's the symbol of Lucifer, the devil. This is all proved in my book, The New World Order, second book, and it shows you the connection between the worship of the sun and the worship of Lucifer. They are connected. It's a symbol of Lucifer.
No, of course, there's no question at all that J. Edgar Hoover covered up what happened as far as the assassination was concerned, as did the Warren Commission, and there was certainly a strong Masonic ties there. And there were also ties to the CFR, but what people don't understand is the CFR, Council on Foreign Relations, came out of Masonry because, of course, the CFR is a front for a group known as the Round Table. The Round Table was a front for a Cecil Rhodes secret society. It was created in 1891. Both Rhodes and Milner were Masons. Certainly Stead, who was the third member of the secret society, was deeply involved in the occult. He was a theosophist and into spiritualism. Well, if you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question or comment, give us a call here at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And certainly Ralph is one of the most best informed people dealing with the Masonic movement, which permeates every aspect of our life. Many of our judges, many of our military leaders, and this is how you get ahead in the military and many police forces. This is how, of course, you'll get ahead many times in business. If you are a Mason, you give the secret handshake. Why, of course, you'll be promoted. Also, within religion, it has been estimated that up to 40% of Southern Baptist ministers are also members of Masonry, which is, of course, why they will never speak out. And if you are a minister and you speak out, chances are you'll have somebody on your board of elders who is a Mason, and they will, of course, get rid of you. We have a book that has Charles Finney's story of Masonry. Charles Finney wrote about Masonry and the murder of Captain Morgan back in the early 1830s. And in that book, there are four stories by ministers who talked in their pulpits about Masonry and immediately lost their churches. So this is the power that we're really aligned against us today. And, of course, it is simply one of the problems. We know, for instance, that J. Edgar Hoover appointed Masons to keep his decisions in the FBI. Masons and Mormons, and, of course, Mormonism, although most Mormons don't know this, Mormonism came out of Masonry because, of course, Joseph Smith was a Mason. The secret ceremonies of Mormonism all came out of Masonry. So we got real problems. Let's go to Scott calling from Pasco, Washington. Hi, Scott.
Hello, Dr. Stan.
How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. I'd like to ask your guest what insight or knowledge does he have about the Bush family and their obvious ties to Freemasonry and George Bush Sr.'s comments and Barbara's comments and all their Masonry terms that they've used.
Yes, that's true. The New World Order is a Masonic term. And George Bush introduced the phrase in 1990, as you know, and then talked about it repeatedly. And in fact, others have did it. Dan Quayle talked about it.
Yes.
Gorbachev talked about it. Fidel Castro talked about it.
Gary Hart.
The Masonic phrase. He talked about the thousand points of light, which is a New Age phrase. Came from, Annie Besant?
No,
or Alice Bailey.
Bailey wrote about the New World Order back in the early 1930s, 1940s, and she wrote about the thousand points of light. Of course, George Bush picked up on this. Everybody thought he was talking about a lot of people working together towards the common good. But if you were an occultist, if you were, of course, into Satanism, you would have understood the significance of the term.
Now, let me say this. The Masons have officially denied that George Sr., the father, is a Mason. They deny. I've got letters, copies of their letters issued. Now, he's not on their list, but I'll give you one little clue, and that's all that is. It's just one of those little things that, is it a coincidence or not? You'll have to decide for yourself. When George Bush threw out the baseball at Yankee Stadium his last year in office, he's a left-hander. He was on the mound throwing the ball towards the catcher, and the photographer is behind the catcher, taking a picture up the straight ahead into the pitcher's mound, and George Bush is about two-thirds of the way around throwing his ball with the left hand. That means his right shoulder is facing the camera, and you can see George Bush's face very clear. George Bush was wearing one of the Yankee blue windbreakers. It's a little blue kind of a lightweight thing that the pitchers wear and others wear to keep their arms warm.
Right.
He's wearing one. And on the right sleeve is the number 33. Is that a coincidence? Notice there's 100 numbers or even no number at all. But he's got the number 33. What does that tell us? I have no way of... I can't say it means he's a Mason. The Masons have denied it. I'll give you one more clue that George Bush is a Mason. I got a letter from a psychologist in someplace in Silver Springs, like Maryland, who said that George Bush, he put it in writing, the father was a member of his lodge. But the Masons have officially denied it. So what are you going to do? We don't know.
All I can say, of course, he is a part of the Skull and Bones. And Skull and Bones is a secret occult society tracing back to 1832. And, of course, it came out of a lodge in Bavaria, which was, of course, many people believe was closely tied to the Illuminati. This secret Bavarian society came up maybe about a decade after we know the Illuminati was organized in Europe there. So, but there's no question at all that the Skull and Bones is a secret pagan organization. Anybody can get our four-tape set on the Skull and Bones, the book we carry by Alexandra Robbins, Secrets of the Tomb, and of course we carry all the membership lists of the Skull and Bones from their own membership list. So we have all that information. So it really doesn't matter whether they're Masons or parallel organizations. My contention that they may very well be parallel organizations. The Skull and Bones, the Bohemian Grove, the Council on Foreign Relations, Communism, Socialism, Humanism, Masonry, Theosophy, Rosicrucians, they all tie back to the ancient mystery religions, back to the Knights Templar, and long, long, long before that. In fact, Albert Pike talks about how modern-day Masonry is a continuation of the mystery religions. That's what it's really about. Would you agree with that, Ralph?
Absolutely, no question. That is said by Albert Pike in his own literature. That's correct.
Anything else? Scott?
Does your guest know, was there any significance on the particular Bible that G.W. Bush swore in on at his inauguration?
This is a very curious thing, and there's no, we can't say. All we know is that he was sworn in. He was tried to be sworn in on the Bible that was used by George Washington, a very visible Mason, the first time George Washington took the oath of office. George Sr. actually had the Bible, apparently. George Jr. tried to have it, I believe, and I think they refused to let him use it because it's getting rather deteriorated. So you can draw whatever inference you want, one of which would be that it would be that he's a Mason, but there's no evidence of that. And I don't believe in trying to document, I'm saying things without documentation, so we cannot say that either Bush is a Mason.
Okay, but there's no question they belong to the Skull and Bones. There are about six or seven Bushes that belong to this. It's an intergenerational grandfather, Prescott Bush, who stole Geronimo's skull, was a member of Skull and Bones. He was also, of course, indicted for helping Adolf Hitler during the Second World War. We never talk about that much. And Papa Bush, and now George W. is all Skull and Bones. I would certainly feel a lot better if he would renounce his secret oaths, secret pagan oaths he swore, entering that, and of course get rid of the Skull and Bones people in his administration. But instead of doing that, he brings them into key positions. Anything else, Scott?
No, thank you very much for being a watchman on the wall that all you gentlemen are. Thank you.
God bless you. Thank you, Scott. And if you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question or comment, don't hesitate to call. Our guest is Ralph Epperson. Ralph, why don't you get your telephone number out there one more time?
Thank you. If you want a copy of my review of Morals and Dogma, it's free. I don't charge for it. It's about 70-some pages long. Call me on my 800 number, which, of course, that means I pay for the call. I'm trying to make it as easy as I can. I want you to know about the Masonic Lodge. It's 800-422-3888. 800-422-3888. Call me. You can call right now or call later or even tomorrow. I'll answer the phone if I'm available. I only have one line coming in, so my caller ID my call waiting will pick it up if I don't. But please call me. I'll send it to you free, no charge.
And of course, Ralph's got some great videos and pamphlets and a lot of great material. If you want to get into this subject, it's an important subject that you understand because, of course, the Masons are incredibly powerful in America today. And if you go into court and there's a Masonic judge and your adversary is a Mason, you've lost. I mean, you don't stand a chance because they have to work together because of the oath they've sworn, which is why no Mason should be a judge or should be a prosecutor.
That's correct. Exactly right. That's right. And by the way, you can see that in that movie about the Dale Beckwith and the murder of Medgar Evers.
What was the title of that?
Evers. You had it. You said it.
Was that Mississippi Burning?
That's correct. Interesting movie. The Red Coat, they cannot, obviously, the producers of the movie cannot say it was the Shriners. But that's the implication. I admit that. It's an implication. Over and over again, Dale Beckwith is very proud of the movie that he will not be found guilty. He laughs at it. He mocks the prosecuting on this latest trial. He mocks him. He says, "You'll never get me again." Now, and the last day of the trial, he wears a red coat, and he's got a little bitty badge, or a little bitty thing, a lapel pin that's flashing in gold, and they don't show you what it is because they can't. But it looks like, and that's all you can say, is the square and the compass, the sign that he's a Mason. And then the number one witness shows up, also wearing a red blazer, and he's got a little shiny, as I remember, a little shiny thing in his lapel, and the implication is that both these men are Shriners, and they've taken an oath to protect themselves. The second man was, of course, the detective or policeman, retired policeman, who gave Dale Beckwith an alibi as being up north 120 or some miles away at the time of the shooting. And we know for certain that Dale Beckwith did it. So the Masons will protect themselves, even in murder cases.
And of course, how can you have a organized society where the oath means absolutely nothing? But you see, they have sworn an oath to a more powerful being than the God that we worship, at least from their point of view. They've sworn an oath to Lucifer, and even though many of the Masons don't understand that, that is the very truth of what this is about.
Well, let me. We should maybe appropriately talk about the latest, the number one Mason that we both know, aware of, and that's Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan apparently was not a Mason during the time, all the way through his governorship and the presidency. But in the last year of his office, I think it was in 1990, in 1988, whenever it was, I've got it documented. I've got pictures of it that were released by the Masons of President Reagan in the White House, receiving an honorary 33rd degree plaque from three men, the three top Masons in the nation, and he's smiling and happy. Then there's a photocopy of the letter in the Masonic literature that we didn't make this up, signed by Ronald Reagan, clearly on White House stationery, written to Brother Kleinecht. And then he says at the bottom of the letter, and he's proud to associate himself with the other 15 members, other 15 presidents who were members of the Masonic Lodge. Now that sounds to me like he's more than an honorary, but I can't prove that. All I can say is that he became an honorary. Now just 6 months before that, approximately, the Church of England found that the rituals of the Masonic Lodge were blasphemous. Blasphemous. Now you could argue about how much the Church of England is a Christian organization, but at least it was a warning that maybe Reagan should not have become an honorary. A friend of mine who was a Reagan supporter said, well, Ralph, he did it because it's just customary presidents do this. And I said, okay, if the Ku Klux Klan offered him an honorary, would he do that as well? That was the end of the discussion.
Well, of course, I think that he did actually send out letters to the other leading Masons, referring to them as brother. And of course, as people have forgotten that Ronald Reagan's wife was deeply involved with astrology and the occult.
I want to point out one more thing. Larry McDonald said it was not only Nancy, it was Ronald Reagan himself. Larry McDonald, the congressman that was allegedly shot down in that Korean airliner, said it was Ronald Reagan himself. I just found that article in the newspaper after having it in my files for 10 or 12 years.
Send me a copy of that as well.
Sure.
We carry a book called The Dove Connection, written by a gentleman, a retired military officer, who had actually studied the college where Ronald Reagan had attended. And, of course, Ronald Reagan said, everything I believe. He was against, of course, raising taxes. And, of course, he did cut the taxes when he came in. And then in 1986, he gave us the largest tax increase in the history of the United States. He was in favor of a balanced budget. He gave us the biggest government deficits we'd ever had. Certainly, Jimmy Carter increased the national debt $200 billion during his 4 years in office. $200 billion. Ronald Reagan increased the national debt $200 billion every year he was in office. But you see, there's a difference between the reality and the rhetoric. Ronald Reagan was against communism, and yet, of course, he ended up embracing Gorbachev. He was going to build the Star Wars, but, of course, we never built Star Wars. And so there were things you talk about, and of course, this is what we remember. He expanded welfare. He expanded government spending. He expanded government control over our lives. A few of the things he did, I think, were very, very good. He got out of UNESCO, but, of course, and certainly he would appear to have been very pro-life. He certainly talked that way, but of course there was funding for Planned Parenthood during his administration, who were, of course, financing abortion. So we say one thing, we do another, you get credit from both sides. But of course, some of the worst Supreme Court justices who are sitting on the Supreme Court today came from Ronald Reagan, 33rd degree Ronald Reagan. I'm speaking of Justice Kennedy and Sandra Day O'Connor. And you say, well, he put on one or two good Supreme Court justices. He did, but never enough to swing the court. That's, of course, what nobody ever mentions.
May I suggest a movie to your listening audience?
Sure.
If you want to see when Reagan started to figure it out, I would urge you to watch for the movie called Santa Fe Trail. And it was made in 1940 with Ronald Reagan and Errol Flynn. And in the movie, Errol Flynn and Ronald Reagan portray General Custer, and I think the other general is Sherman. And of course, this is starts at West Point. And they of course, later became very famous, but they were not very well known. But the story starts with them both going to West Point. I think they're both in the same graduating class. And after they got out, they both became assigned the duty as second lieutenants of helping chase down John Brown, the abolitionist. John Brown was running around Kansas, I think it was, or maybe Missouri, I've forgotten which one, killing whole towns of people because they were pro-slavery or whatever it was. And so in the movie, John Brown goes to Boston, Massachusetts. He's portrayed by Raymond Massey. In fact, he even looks somewhat like John Brown. It doesn't matter. He went there to Boston, Massachusetts, and walks into a room where there's about six or eight men, all portrayed as very wealthy and powerful, great, distinguished, very well-dressed. Every hair is in place. And the spokesman for the group says, who are you and what do you want? He says, well, I'm John Brown. I'm here to raise money. And they say, why should we give you money, John Brown? And Brown explains, and the last part of that little sequence has the leader of the group saying, you tell us how much you'll need and you'll have it.
Well, of course, this was by because they wanted the war?
Yes.
Because they wanted it.
Exactly. The wealthy benefited, of course, by war. They always do.
Right.
Now, why would these wealthy people want John Brown, who's running around killing people? That doesn't make sense. But Reagan watched that, and I believe Reagan said, wait a minute, something's going on here. This is not right. Why would wealthy people finance a crazy man like John Brown running around killing whole towns, men, women, and children? And I think from that point on, Reagan started figuring it out. And I'll give you the second evidence. During the Goldwater campaign, I was a young volunteer, I was in my early 20s, and I was working for the Goldwater campaign, and I know, and you know this too, Dr. Stan, you were probably around then, Barry Goldwater was viciously attacked by the media. You know that. They put out commercials of atomic bombs going off, little girls plucking petals off of a daisy or something, and the sky lights up, and this is what Goldwater's going to do to us. That's how vicious this attack became. But Ronald Reagan was running around the country during 64. I heard him myself speak probably three times about, as a conservative, talking about the need to elect Barry Goldwater. But Reagan never got attacked. Never.
Well, I think it was so interesting that after he left Hollywood, who should put him on the television but the GE Corporation, one of the major corporations behind this whole world movement towards the New World Order and the New World Religion. So they kept him before the public. And, of course, it was always, I think you're absolutely right. Isn't it amazing he never got attacked like Barry Goldwater?
Now, let me finish this. This is also very revealing. After the election, the Californians had created a thing called the United Republicans of California that gave Goldwater a pre-primary endorsement so that the Californians in the state would hopefully vote for Goldwater, and they did. They elected Goldwater in the primary. Now, Ronald Reagan, after that was over, ran for governor, and the same group supported him. They were the ones that did they had 14,000 members statewide, volunteer, hardcore conservatives, people who were patriots, loved their country, and they did what they could to raise the money, do the precinct work, everything, to elect Ronald Reagan. And then they sat back and watched 8 years of this man lie. They've issued a resolution. I have copies of it. The year that Reagan first announced, I think it was 76 or 74, whenever it was, when he first announced he was running for the presidency, condemning him unanimously, and urging the people in the Republican Party to not have anything to do with Ronald Reagan. Now, these were the people that stood by and watched him promise A and deliver Z. And that resolution's about 5 pages long of little short paragraphs. Here's what he promised. Here's what he did. And that's exactly as you just pointed out, Dr. Stan, what he did as president. He promised A and did Z, not B, but Z as in zebra, the exact opposite. And they were so fed up with this man, they issued a unanimous resolution condemning him. If you want it, I'll send it to you. I'll let you see it. It's bizarre. They knew, they saw this man, and yet we all conservatives raced down to vote for this man.
Well, I'll tell you what, reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. Ralph, thank you so much for being with us. It's always a pleasure. Get that telephone number out one more time.
800-422-3888. 800-422-3888. Call me, get a free copy of the Review of Morals and Dollars. Dr. Stan, God bless you. Keep up the good work. I'll be your guest anytime you ask.
Oh, I'll be getting on again sometime soon. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
God bless you.
Okay, you too. Well, that was Ralph Epperson. Let me just comment that they're going to be having a, starting an Institute of the Constitution. I will be on September 25th. That's just two nights from now. You should be there at the Shiloh Inn at 7 o'clock in the evening. And of course, if you want to know more information, call 509-891-7428. That's 509-891-7428. And, of course, we need, of course, to get people to understand the miracle of America, which, of course, was actually personified in the Constitution. And, of course, what was it? We were a Christian nation. We were founded by Christians. And, of course, this would be the great experiment to see if men could really live free. And, of course, this nation was created under God. We look to God for the source of our freedom, not to government. In fact, the whole idea was we would limit the power of government, and liberty and limited government were to be synonymous. Tyranny and total government were to be synonymous. You need to learn about the Christian history of America. I hope that you will certainly be going to that Institute of the Constitution. That's two nights from now, and of course you're excused from attending Radio Liberty programs for those evenings. Get informed, and then help us to get other people involved. Freedom will be lost if not enough people understand the foundations upon which our freedom rests. And of course, till tomorrow, we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for our leaders, for revival. Lastly, we ask you to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. So until tomorrow evening at the same time. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you that the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. We welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us right now, on the line from Sacramento, Randy Thomason of Campaign for California Families. Randy, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, Dr. Finn. Good to talk to you.
Well, tell us what's going on up there in Sacramento.
Well, all eyes are on the recall. Of course, today's news is that the recall is going to be on October 7th. The Ninth Circuit, an 11-judge panel, unanimously reversed that 3-judge panel that had put the election on hold. And it struck me, I mean, this Ninth Circuit is the most liberal in the state, the most anti-God court in the country. Remember, they struck down the words under God in the Pledge of Allegiance last year. And it seems that the public scrutiny is a good antidote for arrogance. People all over the country saw these black-robed liberals sitting there, and the people were mad at these guys at the thought that they would delay an election over some ridiculous claim that that the elections of the past were bad because they were punch card ballots. It looked stupid, sounded stupid. I think the pressure on these justices was immense. They handed down their ruling today, reversed the 3 judges, let the election go forward.
Now, what do the polls look like at the present time? Now, of course, you can't depend upon the polls, but what do they look like? Certainly, we have three. If Davis is recalled, we have 3 candidates, Bustamante, Schwarzenegger, and McClintock. What do the polls look like?
Well, the polls, I think, show that it's still a 3-man race. There was the LA Times poll last week, which was sort of verified by the Public Policy of Institute of California poll that was released on Sunday, and you have basically Bustamante in the high 20s, Schwarzenegger in the mid-20s, and then McClintock in the high teens.
Now, I was told yesterday by John Stuess he was up to 21%. Now, whether that's their poll or somebody else's, I don't know.
Yes, there are some internal polls that show Tom McClintock in the low 20s. And I think that adds validity to the statement, this is a 3-man race. And I want to give a word to the people out there. When you look at, if you're a person of faith, you can look at it one way. If you're a person who is not a person of faith, you can look at it another way. But let me speak to people of faith. You are given the power of the vote by God who gave us this country. I would recommend highly that you vote according to the values that you know strengthen families. And ask yourself, if I vote for such and such candidate, does my vote glorify God? And obviously I'm suggesting not to dumb down your values, but to hold up a high standard of values. And Dr. Stan, I'd like to play for you and your listeners right now a radio announcement that we have given to several radio stations around the state to air, and it's me talking, and it is talking about the distinction between the candidates on moral issues, and I'd like to play that for you right now. Is that all right?
Sure, that's all right.
Okay, I'm going to hold this up to a tape recorder.
Hi, my name is Randy Thomason, Executive Director of Campaign for California Families. Can we talk about the governor's race? Cruz Bustamante, Tom McClintock, Arnold Schwarzenegger? It's a 3-man race. Any of them could win, and the vote of Christians will make a difference on Election Day. So where do the candidates stand on the vital issues, like abortion and the homosexual agenda? Well, for starters, the only major candidate to sign the Marriage Protection Pledge is Senator Tom McClintock. McClintock has pledged in writing to protect the legal rights of marriage for only a man and a woman. He opposes the homosexual domestic partner's agenda, and Tom McClintock is pro-life on abortion. Refusing to sign the Marriage Protection Pledge are Bustamante, Schwarzenegger, and Gray Davis. Cruz, Arnold, and Gray all support homosexual domestic partnerships, gay adoptions, and abortion on demand. On October 7th, vote for the values you hold dear. For more information, visit SaveCalifornia.com.
And that's the type of message we're hoping gets out to a lot of people, because there are a lot of people who think, well, I can't vote for my values because those values won't win. Wrong. This is a 3-man race, and you've got a very liberal anti-family Democrat named Cruz Bustamante, You've got a liberal Republican named Schwarzenegger, and then you've got a pro-family state senator named Tom McClintock. And I would just encourage people, vote for the values you hold dear. And this race is off and going.
Okay,
I'll,
fine.
I'll be on the 7th.
Okay, anything else you want to comment on this evening?
Well, I'm doing another project on the side, and I'd like to give a website.
Okay.
It's called votemarriage.com, and this is actually a special project to get radio ads on a lot of stations around the state to let people know where the candidates really, really stand. It's a different ad than what I played for you, but it's a very powerful ad that shows people that there is a pro-family candidate that could be elected governor. So visit votemarriage.com, and we'd like to ask you to take a look and even donate toward this, because the truth can win if the light exposes the darkness, but we got to put some batteries in the flashlight to expose the darkness. Your funding of this effort can help shine the light and create a victory. Dr. Stan, it's good to hear your voice doing so well, by the way.
It's doing ever so much better. Well, thank you so much, Randy. Really appreciate it. Keep up the good work. We'll look forward to talking to you next week. And then, of course, the week after that will be, of course, Doomsday or maybe a good day. We'll have to wait.
Well, and get boned up on the election issues. We've got a big recall election center with a lot of information on the candidates. It's all at SaveCalifornia.com, and that's a great place to visit to get boned up and start spread the word on where the candidates stand.
God bless. Thanks so much, Randy.
Thanks, Dr. Stan.
Bye-bye. Okay, fine. So let's go then, of course, to Brad Dacus from the Pacific Justice Institute. Brad, tell us what's going on in the legal fields.
Well, Dr. Stan, we just filed a major lawsuit against the union activists and some government officials who were, we believe, behind what took place in a terrible event against some pro-recall demonstrators. It was on August 9th. I'm sure you've probably heard about it. They were out there demonstrating peacefully, a small group, a couple women, a little 8-year-old boy, and some a dad, and some men. And the union thugs across the street were attending this conference called WAR, Workers Against Recall. It was W-A-R. That was their name of it. And put up by the different unions, and we believe it was the endorsement of the UC system, our taxpayer-funded UC system. And so they saw these demonstrators protesting what they believe was abuse of taxpayer funds for this political event, and these union thugs crossed the street, charged across the street, and beat up these people. One was rushed to the emergency ward in the hospital. Another little 8-year-old boy saw his dad being beat to a pulp. And the union guy beating him up told the boy to shut up or he'd do the same to him that he was doing to his dad. And needless to say, and then, of course, that boy has been in major emotional trauma because of this. And these people wanted to file a lawsuit, and they called us. We didn't call them. They called us the Pacific Justice Group. And needless to say, we have filed a major lawsuit against all the parties involved. And the good news, Dr. Stanley, is that we actually have part of it on videotape. And we're going to be subpoenaing the major media networks that were there also to get their videotapes. And once we can identify the actual individuals, the police department has assured us that they'll file criminal charges. But it's up to us to get those films and through our civil litigation.
Good for you. Well, I think that that's the only way to deal with thugs like that.
Yep. And you know, Dr. Stanley, so people understand the significance of it. I mean, next time it could be pro-homeschoolers. The next time it could be pro-life activists. You know, they're beaten up by people. If they get away with it, they'll do it again. And I even know a church in San Francisco where the people in the church had to be escorted out by police because the thugs outside were threatening violence. As opposed, instead of arresting the thugs outside, they escorted the people out the back door. And no arrests were made then either. So we have to send a message to these people that if you're going to engage in kind of violent tactics to bridge people's freedom and liberty and law-abiding, God-fearing people who want to express themselves, then there's a heavy cost that they're going to have to pay. And we as Pacific Justice Group intend to make sure that they pay that cost.
God bless you. Thanks for what you're doing, Randy.
Thank you,
I mean, Brad.
That's okay.
Okay. Thanks so much. Will I be seeing you this weekend?
Yes, you will, and hopefully my wife and little boy will be there too. And if anyone would like to get caught up on our cases, they can look at our webpage at pacificjustice.org, pacificjustice.org, and there are more cases coming down, I assure you.
God bless. Thanks so much, Brad.
Thank you, Dr. Stanley. Bye-bye.
Okay, fine. Well, of course, that was Brad and Randy, and of course, bringing you up to date. The Pacific Justice Institute does a great job of representing people pro bono. If they take your case, they don't charge you for it. If there's a settlement, you get the settlement. They're there to help Christians who are under pressure from various sources out there. And how are you going to get good representation without being run into the poorhouse? Well, that's what the Pacific Justice Institute is all about, and we certainly hope that many of you will support them. PacificJustice.org. They deserve your support. Well, right now, let's go to Dr. William Drescher. Dr. Drescher, are you there?
I'm here.
And, of course, Dr. Drescher was involved with this whole issue of asbestos. So I'm going to let him talk a little bit about asbestos and why, of course, one of the great miscarriages of justice has been this idea of saying all these lawsuits about asbestos are justified. They've forced many of our major corporations into bankruptcy. We've got a lot of rich lawyers. And a lot of people have made a lot of money on this, but we've destroyed the asbestos industry, and most of this, of course, totally unboarded. So would you explain to our listeners what this is really all about?
Well, the problem is, Dr. Stan, that asbestos is a generic word. And it's like, suppose you're a member of the Smith family, and one of the Smiths is a rogue. And that means that all Smiths are rogues. Asbestos is a generic word that covers about six different minerals. And there are three minerals in that, half of them in that category, that have some degree of cancer-causing capability. However, the one that's used the most, and certainly more than 90% in the United States, and mined in the United States and Canada, is chrysotile. That's a serpentine mineral, and known as white asbestos. And there's never been a cancer case shown for the inhalation of chrysotile, even amongst workers of chrysotile. Here in Arizona, for example, one of the better grades of chrysotile was mined up until relatively recently. And since 1914, there had never been a case brought before the Arizona Workers' Compensation Fund for any lung ailment regarding the chrysotile, even though the dust levels in the mines and mills in the early days were far in excess of anything permitted today.
Well, of course, when I lived in South Africa, there was there was the mesotheliomas, but that was caused by a different type of asbestos.
That's right.
And was that used at all in the United States, and if so, where was it used?
Well, unfortunately, it has been used as admixtures with other forms of asbestos, and therein lies the problem. Unless you can really analyze and know whether or not that has been present in the past, it's difficult to determine whether there's a hazard involved. It's used really rarely, however, it has been used. The problem arises from the fact that all asbestos now has been painted with a brush of chrysotillite or the South African blue.
All right, and so as far as you know, why the American asbestos was not harmful, and yet, of course, was this what they were using in shingles and in insulation and things like that?
That's right.
And of course,
asbestos tile and other products.
All right, of course, and yet, of course, anybody whoever worked with asbestos as long as they used the word asbestos, immediately, of course, the manufacturer was considered guilty, even though his asbestos product was one of those that was totally benign.
That's right.
What happened when they had the lawsuits? Why didn't they bring the facts out at the lawsuits?
It was brought out, but the problem is that we have trial by jury in this country. And juries are very non-scientific.
But why couldn't you get lawyers that would be good enough to really bring out the facts? It seems
to me
that...
That's a good question. Of course, there's been some very good lawyers on this subject.
Now, did you do any professional testimony in the cases?
I did some advisory work. I worked for Union Carbide at one time and involved with their asbestos. And over the years, I've done advisory work for them, yes.
Well, is asbestos still outlawed totally here in the United States?
It's not outlawed, no. But any company that would dare to use it in the product is flirting with catastrophe.
Well, I remember I had a house, and we were going to have to take the shingles off and put on new ones. And, you know, that was the major cost was, what are you going to do with these shingles? Because they were asbestos, and you had to take them to a special dump, and, of course, a tremendous expense because, of course, this was toxic. And they probably had nothing to do with the dangerous type of asbestos. And yet, of course, the EPA was considering asbestos as asbestos without considering whether it was harmful or not.
That's right.
So what's the solution to the problem?
That's a good question. You know, so far, no one has found it. We've tried to educate people, such as this broadcast tonight. But so long as we have the litigation situation that we have in the United States today, this goes on. And I mean, this is rather large. So far, there's been more than 600,000 asbestos disease claimants. Something like $54 billion has been put out so far. 60 companies have gone into bankruptcy. It's a real catastrophe.
Yeah, and sort of like the breast implants, the Dow Corning breast implants. Of course, the statistics now, a decade later, show there's no higher incidence of autoimmune disease among women with the breast implants than those without. But, of course, it's cost Dow Corning billions and billions of dollars for absolutely nothing. But I'll tell you what, we got some awfully rich lawyers.
That's right.
All right. Well, is there anything else that you think that we should bring up as far as the asbestos issue is concerned?
I don't think of anything at the moment. The main thing is to bring out that there are good forms of asbestos and bad forms of asbestos.
And, of course, the individual can't tell that. And, of course, the manufacturer would know.
That's right.
Even if he did know, it wouldn't make any difference when he gets into court.
That's right.
Well, you would think, of course, that there would be some way to circumvent this sort of misuse of the jury system.
Yes, unfortunately, we've not found a way to do that.
Well, I thank you so much for being with us this evening.
You're very welcome.
My guest has been Dr. Drescher, and we've just been talking about and pointing out there's various types of asbestos, and, of course, there's the good types, there's the bad types, but almost all of the asbestos used in the United States has been non-toxic, and yet because of the lawsuits, John Mansfield went down. I understand Halliburton has lots of lawsuits, and they're trying to come back again for another round of lawsuits. What a gross miscarriage of justice. Well, justice is supposed to be blind and not favor the trial lawyers who give so much money to the legislature so that they can continue robbing the public. God bless you. Thank you so much, Dr. Drescher.
You're very welcome.
Bye-bye. Yeah. Okay, fine. Well, I'm going to ask, of course, our special producer tonight, if you'll get John Spring on the line, and we'll spend some time here with John and, of course, talking about what's going on. John, as you know, has his own program in Southern California and is good enough to come on with us from time to time. John is a geographer and trained in geography. I've been... Of course, geography deals not only with simply land masses, but the geopolitical issues associated with those land masses. And certainly, if we stop and we look at what's happened as far as America's wars in the Middle East, we went to war in Afghanistan not to get Osama bin Laden. In fact, he was not even targeted. We did not even try to do anything at all to capture Osama bin Laden. We went to war in Afghanistan to get the Taliban out of control so we could run a pipeline through there, and we got the Taliban out. And only after the Taliban had defeated did we go after bin Laden. By that time, it escaped. You see, we have to tell the American people we were going after the wicked terrorists and the Al-Qaeda network. But, of course, if you read this book, in fact, we'll be carrying it. It's called Crude Politics. It's written by Paul Sperry, who is the Washington correspondent for WorldNet Daily. Why he points out that, and of course, if you remember what happened, why we did not go after Osama bin Laden. In fact, we have an article out of the Washington Times, and we'll be glad to get copies of it for any of our listeners, wherein, of course, the high military officer said, our policy is not Osama bin Laden first in Afghanistan. Our policy is Osama bin Laden last, because if we got Osama bin Laden, how would we justify the war against the Taliban? And that's what it was really all about. It wasn't about Osama bin Laden. It was about getting the Taliban out of office and building the pipeline, because, of course, we allowed them to escape and, of course, to set up shop there. And, of course, we've actually captured and killed two-thirds of the al-Qaeda leaders. And we pretty well emasculated them. If we got rid of Osama bin Laden, that would be the end of al-Qaeda. But, of course, if we did that, how would we justify continuing the war on terror, continuing the Patriot Act and the Victory Act, continuing the Office of Homeland Security? But, of course, the administration knows that the war on terror is really not a major factor. That's why they haven't sealed our border or armed our airline pilots. They're only, as of this week, only 200 airline pilots have been armed in 2 years. Only recently have they talked about beginning to check the baggage that's going on to passenger planes. And I'm talking about the, actually not just the baggage, but the cargo going on to passenger planes to make sure it doesn't contain explosives. 2 years after the September 11th attack, we're just getting around to that. We're just getting around to putting 5,000 new marshals onto the planes. What do the people in Washington, D.C. know that we don't know about the war on terrorism? Well, I'll tell you what they do know, and that is that they picked up all the Al-Qaeda network, which was very real, and it was here. And it was here on September 11th, and on September 12th, we started arresting it. And we picked up 1,200 Muslims in the next 2 days, 3 days. How did we know who to arrest? Because we were monitoring them all online. And we can't let the American people know that. That's why we're still keeping them. That's why we won't release their names. That's why 2 years later, they're still being held as potential terrorists, because we knew who the terrorists were. And we won't release their names, not because we don't want Mohammed Atta to know who they were, or Osama bin Laden, because we don't want the American people to know that we knew a great deal about the terrorist movement long before September 11th. But, of course, if we knew it, why didn't we try to stop the attack? It would have stopped the attack. Do you really think we would have gone to war in Afghanistan? If it hadn't been the attack, do you really think we'd be at war in Iraq today with American boys dying every day? Well, with us on the line now is John Spring. Hi, John. How are you doing?
Real fine, Dr. Stan. It's a pleasure to be on your program.
Well, tell me what you've learned here that you'd like to talk about tonight.
Well, I've been learning so much from the guests on my own program, guests whom you've also had recently on your program, such as Bernadine Smith and Charlotte Isserbeat. One thing in particular, I don't know if Bernadine or Charlotte have shared this with you, but there was a map produced back in 1942, actually, but it was completed in October of 1941 that was called to my attention. It's called the Gomberg Map. I don't know if you've heard of this or not, but in reviewing it and studying it, it's rather fascinating in that the New World Order was literally mapped out prior to Pearl Harbor.
And this is, of course, the regionalization of America.
Not only the regionalization of America, but the regionalization of the entire world by what would become basically the United Nations.
Well, of course, we know the United Nations was planned back in 1908. We actually have an article out of the American Journal of History in the fall of 1908 talking about the fact that the First World War was coming, this greatest war of all time,
yes,
followed by the United Nations. They knew that. If any of you want that article, we'd be glad to send it to you. They knew this whole thing was coming. It's all been scripted. Well, we can't let the American people know that. Oh, they might then, of course, object to sending our boys over to fight and bleed and suffer and die in Iraq, because we're not going to be there for a year. We're going to be there for at least 10 years, according to Paul Sperry. That's what the Pentagon is planning on, and maybe 50 years, for all I know.
Yes, but if I may go back to this Gomberg map for just a moment, Dr. Stan, one thing that is unique and interesting about this particular map is that Their concept of the United States of America included Greenland, Canada, Alaska, and as far south as the Caribbean, Central America, and Panama. In other words, the northern portion of the Western Hemisphere, for all practical purposes, was to become the United States of America.
Sort of like the NAFTA agreement, except just going a little further south and a little further east.
Exactly. Very similar to NAFTA. And we have to understand, of course, that in Europe, before they had the United States of Europe or the European Union, they did have such things. First of all, they started out as Benelux, and then they continued on with the European Common Market, and then the European Economic Community, and later, what did they have? They had the European Union, basically. So this is a series of stepping stones to bring about regionalization, but to, first of all, water down the sovereignty of the various nations, and then put forth a realm of the UN, basically, and then the sub-regions of that realm we might refer to as regions. And as was pointed out in some of the material I received from these fine ladies that I just alluded to, during the Nixon administration, there were 10 regions signed into law by President Nixon. And for the benefit of your listening audience, California, Arizona, Nevada, and Hawaii were part of what was referred to as Region 9. The states to the north of us, which would include Idaho, Oregon, Washington, and Alaska, were part of Region 10. Now, what's sort of interesting regarding our local politics here in the state of California is that if you combine these two regions, you have, for all practical purposes, the same jurisdiction or Ninth Circuit Court District, basically. And circuit courts can be very useful in terms of bringing about regional policies or federal policies throughout a region, and at the same time breaking down the authority of a state's sovereignty, as was attempted by this last circuit court ruling, which apparently has been rescinded as of today.
Well, I think people have to understand, they really want to get away from state sovereignty and get people into regions. And, of course, usually the people then who control the regions are not answerable to the people that are appointed by the federal government. All of this is long-range planning to do an end run around the Constitution and establish this dictatorship controlled from the top down rather than, of course, from the bottom up. Because, of course, the real goal is to control the public, to establish a fascist, a corporate, socialist state, long-range planning. All you need to do is go to Foreign Affairs magazine, April of 1974, read the article by Richard Gardner talking about how we're going to do an end run around the Constitution to create our new world order. We'll be back here in just a moment with John Spring. Welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, Dr. Stan back here. Our guest this evening is John Spring. So, of course, these maps have been around for a long time. I remember seeing them many, many years ago, but I'm glad that, of course, that Charlotte and Bernadine Smith are getting this information out. They're doing a great job of letting people understand what we're up against is long-range planning. And, of course, America is... of course, eventually to be submerged in this world government, and with that, the end of our freedom, the end of our currency, the end of everything as we've known it here in the United States, as we move from freedom into fascism, into slavery.
Yes, Dr. Stan, regarding the last point that you made regarding currency, this was one of the 41 points that was brought out by Maurice Gomberg, supposedly the cartographer of this map that I'm referring to. And I believe it is in the very last item of the 41 points that he attempts to write about, that there will be a... No, actually, I'm sorry. It's in number 39, I believe, the establishment of a world common monetary system.
Of course, basically, they're trying to get a common currency in Europe.
Yes.
They, of course, want eventually a common currency here in the Western Hemisphere. Maybe it'll be just the northern part, a common currency, or maybe it'll be the whole Western Hemisphere. But once you lose your currency, you lose your sovereignty, and that's really what it's all about. Now, there were those of you who listened to our program last night, remember that Tony called in, and he was referring to an article that was associated with the David Morgan's homepage about a statement put out by the International Monetary Fund saying that the American currency could be destroyed at any moment. I think that was almost the term. We are simply with a massive deficits we're running. We have a totally unstable currency, and their statement was we could be American currency could be destroyed at any moment. So I went onto the webpage, tracked that story down, and Tony was absolutely right. Of course, he mailed it to me or faxed it to me, which I appreciate. And of course, we verified that. We are in real trouble. And if you haven't read, certainly the speech was given by Congressman Ron Paul. You'll find that on his website on the 5th of September, talking about our real monetary crisis where we are. You need to get that, and you need to start making plans accordingly. So go ahead.
Yes, that is very frightening. A little bit off the subject, but if any member of the listening audience is able to translate Polish into English, I would be very appreciative of contacting that individual, and if I guess if you were to just contact Dr. Stan, he in turn could contact me, because I've come across some material related to the Gomberg map that is in Polish. I have a fairly good idea what it's about, but there are many words which I do not understand in Polish. I only understand some German, Spanish, and Japanese besides English, so and a little bit of French. But
well, tell us, who was Gomberg, and what was the background of these maps that he drew up?
Well, all we know at this time in English text is that Gomberg was, apparently Maurice Gomberg was assigned to put together a map. Now, I don't know his political affiliations, but apparently this had something to do with the Roosevelt administration and the aspirations that his administration had for supporting a UN plan. And the word United Nations is mentioned at the bottom of the map where they have these 41 points. Now, this map is roughly 100 by 71 centimeters, if you can get a copy of it. I'm still looking for one of the original color copies. All I have is a sort of a sepia or a Xerox copy of this original map, but for that reason, the various colors shown in gray are not really accurate gradations, but rather they're attempting to show another hue or color. So I'm hoping to be able to get hold of original map to review at some later date. But
all right, John. Well, Chris, was this when in the 1940s was the map done? Was it during the war, before the war, after the war?
This is very significant. This map was completed in October of 1941, approximately 2 months before the Japanese bombing of Pearl Harbor.
Well, of course, the one reason we had to get into the World War II was, of course, we could help to write the peace and establish the United Nations. And, of course, when the Germans tried to surrender, and we would not accept their surrender, it was because we wanted to prolong the war so it would be as bloody and horrible and devastating as possible. That's why, certainly in 1943, why we were ready to invade Europe. And I've talked to General Albert Wedemeyer, who was in charge of planning for the United States Army. We were ready, of course, to invade in 1943, and there was no way, Churchill was going to go along with an invasion in 43. He insisted we invade North Africa, and we invade Italy, and we waste tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of American lives on all these foolish things to draw the war out and prolong it. And, of course, the Japanese kept trying to surrender, and they tried to surrender for 7 months. And we wouldn't accept their surrender, and we invaded Iwo Jima. It wasn't necessary. Okinawa, we dropped the bombs. Anybody who would like the article out of the Chicago Tribune, which was published on the very day we signed the peace treaty in the harbor in Tokyo on the Missouri, Battleship Missouri, we have that article pointing out the Japanese had tried five times previously to surrender. I know this to be true because I talked to General Wedemeyer. He had told me about that. But, of course, we're not going to surrender. We wanted as much bloodshed and horror and terror as possible, because only then would the American people, the people of the world, be willing to give up their freedom and establish the one world order, and eventually, of course, the new world religion.
And, of course, earlier in Europe, I believe it was General Patton who wanted to invade the Axis powers by way of the Balkans, where there would be much less resistance than the fortifications opposite the English Channel, basically, where we took very heavy tolls at Normandy Beachhead, for example. But, of course, the American people have never really been told how tragic that situation was, but they wanted to have a war that would cause so many more needless lives than was actually necessary.
50 million people died in that war, and probably twice that many casualties. A horrible, horrible, horrible war. But I suspect the coming war that we are already in, we are in the Third World War now, and before this is over, why, of course, the American people are going to come to realize that men and women become accomplices to the evils they fail to oppose. And when we go invading other nations, comes the blowback on America.
Yes. Now, just before I had an opportunity to come on the air with you, I heard you speaking very briefly about Afghanistan and the fact that we attempted to bring the Taliban out, to remove the Taliban from power, supposedly so that we could bring a more democratic government into place. But as you pointed out so well, our main objective was not so much to set up a democratic government. In reality, we established a communist government, as shocking as that may seemingly be to the listening audience, but in reality we were attempting to provide a route for a pipeline leading from Turkmenistan to western Pakistan through western Afghanistan.
Down in the Arabian Sea, right?
Yes, correct. But we've been deceived in so many ways. Supposedly Hamid Karzai is the official ruler or leader of Afghanistan and Kabul, but in reality you are never told of the fact that a fellow by the name of Fahim, who is the defense minister, has his own private army, and for all practical purposes he is the individual who calls the shots.
And he's from the Northern Alliance and it is pro-communist.
That is correct. Just like Dostum, one of the warlords that we formed an alliance with for supposedly defeating the Taliban, fought on the side of the Soviet Union and the communist forces until the very end of the Afghan War, when he switched sides. But for some reason, we choose the strangest allies, and then by contrast, in western Afghanistan, where there has been some stability around the city of Herat and the region of Herat, we have attempted to vilify the leader there.
A man named Herat.
The governor of Herat in western Afghanistan. And Ismail Khan, K-H-A-N, has been vilified by Condoleezza Rice as a person that we supposedly need to get rid of because he attempted to establish good relations with the neighboring nation of Iran. And basically, he is of the Sunni faith, the Persians are of the Shia faith, and so basically he wanted to at least tolerate and not to be antagonistic, but he certainly was not about to sell out his nation.
Well, I think what's so interesting is that area of Herat is where the pipeline is going to go. It's going to go
absolutely
quite close there. And so we're making sure that area is stable so that there will won't be sabotage, and so we'll be able to get that pipeline in. I mean, after all, this is what it was all about. You know, no sooner was the war underway, and of course, then as soon as it looked like the war was underway, while we were down there negotiating in Pakistan for the, I think it was right after the bombing began, that we were down there in Pakistan, negotiating for the pipeline. The pipeline was what it was really all about. If it had been about Osama bin Laden, we would have got Osama bin Laden. We did not go after Osama bin Laden. They would not let our special forces go after him. We never targeted Osama bin Laden. That was what we had to tell the American people. That's why we were going into Afghanistan, to get the wicked Osama bin Laden. And then we didn't get him, and we didn't try to get him. And that's all covered in this new book we'll be carrying called Crude Politics. It's the story of the crude oil, and of course,
yes.
And it's a very, very good book. I'm thoroughly enjoying it. We'll be carrying that, Crude Politics by Paul Sperry, and if you request it, we'll give you a copy of our interview with him, one of the best interviews. In fact, that'll be an interview of the month for this month.
Yes, I've heard him on another program being interviewed. He seems to be quite outstanding. If either you or me were able to get him as a guest, that would be great.
Well, we've actually had him as a guest. Call me off the air, I'll give you his number.
Okay, wonderful. But getting back now to the Middle East, another concern that we should have at this moment is the country of Iraq that we supposedly liberated. I almost came up with a new word, illiberated, but supposedly liberated, in that things are not going too well over there. We're losing men and women every day, and it seems as if some spokesperson said today that we do need assistance from the United Nations in the form of foreign troops to supposedly come to our aid, but yet Washington's telling the American people basically that there's no need for a draft, there's no need for more American military personnel to be deployed over there. So it seems as if the Pentagon and the Bush administration is speaking out of both sides of its mouth on this issue.
Well, I think what they hope to do is get other troops to come in. I think South Korea's offered to send in about 10,000 troops, and if we can get other people to come in so that they don't lose so many boys. We're up over 300 American casualties now since the war began. I should say deaths, and probably approaching 2,000 casualties. And of course, they're afraid, frightened that the American people will become disillusioned with the war because of the steady loss of life. Now, they don't want to institute the draft simply because apparently a lot of people are volunteering for service because there are no jobs out there, and foolishly they're joining the military. And of course, they'll simply be cannon fodder in this and the other wars which are planned in that area. And if Iran doesn't crumble, we will, of course, go to war with Iran under one pretext or another. The same is true with Syria and probably with Saudi Arabia as well. How can I say this? Because, of course, William Kristol, who is the chairman of the Project for the New American Century, which controls the Bush administration, said that in an interview in March of this year with Ted Koppel, and we have the complete text of that. In fact, we quote him, at least we quote a certain thing Koppel said, and in one of my interviews, actually, one of my newsletters, I think we quoted Ted Koppel, or we can get people copies of the text. But William Kristol basically said that we are going, of course, to take out South Korea in one way or another. We're not going to let them become a bomb-making factory. And, of course,
North
we will replace the government of Iran and Syria and in Saudi Arabia sooner or later.
Yes. Personally, I think if we're going to do any further invasions throughout the Middle East, Syria would probably be the first because it's not quite as strong as Iran. and it's more of a formidable enemy to Israel, which is in close proximity to Syria. And then possibly, since we control portions of Afghanistan and portions of Iraq, then perhaps we will move into Iran. I hope that we don't, Dr. Stan, just like I hoped we didn't go to war against Iraq, at least when we did, because we were so ill-prepared with logistical and follow-up means to provide for the civilian population, which we have not been able to adequately provide for in rebuilding the infrastructure, even on a temporary basis, so that they could have the basic necessities which we have not provided them with, which, of course, is going to generate more apathy on the part of the Iraqis towards the Americans.
Well, you know what's really interesting, John, is we are nation building. This is the whole idea of we're going to come in, we're going to rebuild this nation exactly as we rebuilt Germany after the Second World War, as we rebuilt Japan. We're going to redesign their educational system. We're going to redesign their healthcare system. We're going to build their roads. We're going to build their industries. This committee that we have appointed, supposedly, as if it represents Iraq, it doesn't represent anybody at all other than the people we put in power. Now they're inviting corporations from all over the world to come in and set up factories or buy a property there. And of course, this is going to become simply a satellite of Western capitalism. But of course, the question is, how do the Iraqi people feel? Will they go along with this? Will we be able to change their attitude through television? Will we be able to change the attitude of their children in the schools we're setting up? We are sending over professional administrators, American administrators, thousands of them with five-year contracts. The plan is at least 10 years there, maybe much longer. And of course, gradually pulling the American troops out, trying to get an Iraqi police force set up, which I totally agree with, trying to get the Iraqis to begin to build their own, to take over control of all of the various things there. But you've got all of these supporters of Saddam Hussein who are there, and you've got the terrorists coming in who simply want to make this continue to be an unsettled area. So I just hope we can pull our troops out
to
the periphery, put them in safe areas, and then, of course, arm the Iraqi people and have them reestablish the government there. It's going to be very easy, very interesting to see what happens, but it's going to cost countless billions of dollars. We've already spent $79 billion. The president's asking for another $87 billion, and, of course, there will be hundreds of billions of dollars more that we'll be investing there. Why are we doing this? Well, of course, the whole idea is we are going to lead the world, but America cannot afford this. You only have to read the story of what happened to ancient Greece. They went bankrupt with their wars, the Peloponnesian Wars, the Punic Wars, and then, of course, Rome went bankrupt over their wars. And, of course, their people were all off defending the outlying empire as the Huns descended upon Rome.
Yes. And as you pointed out in your book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, Great Britain went bankrupt during the at the end of the First World War.
Right.
Yes. I am very concerned. Another document that's been called to my attention, of course, is this document of the State Department that was published in September of 1961.
7277.
Referred to commonly as document 7277. Hmm. And I believe that we are now entering stage three, which calls for the disarmament of the United States, the disbanding of all of our armed forces, and the elimination of all of our military arsenal, basically. The American people seem to be completely oblivious to this possibility, but they need to understand that 42 years have gone by, and we've been ignoring the situation, and yet it's been continuing on from administration to administration. And is it any wonder that, for example, we're not concerned anymore about controlling our own borders and our sovereignty if we have sold out basically to the plan for disarmament, as was the case in 1961, and again supporting that parent public law, the same thing was done in 1989 under the Bush administration, and practically all of our so-called prominent and conservative congressmen, as well as the liberal ones from California and elsewhere, for the most part, at least 400 of them voted in favor of this disarmament document, which was only 3 pages in length, and clarified very clearly what was meant by disarmament and how any American citizen, especially a congressman, could have voted for that is beyond my understanding of logic. But they did, and it's a public law, and it's just going to be a matter of time unless the American people wake up to the fact that we are now entering stage three, and Homeland Security is basically providing the military means to bring about control of the American people, not to provide us with Homeland Security, but to rather place us under the command of the United Nations.
Agreed.
So I am becoming very concerned. And you must understand, although as a geographer I have mentioned things primarily about what are occurring overseas, I have also a very strong background in what is meant by regionalization, regional planning. I understand Marxist planning and Marxist geography as well. And the American people better wake up fairly soon, because we don't have the luxury of 42 years. If we're lucky, we might have 42 months to turn this thing around. But it will take a lot of understanding. I urge everyone to review at least the United States Department of State document 7277. That is a must for every American citizen.
Is that up on the web, do you know?
I don't know if it's on the web. If they wish, they can order it from me. If I may give my mailing address.
You sure can.
Our mailing address is John W. Spring, Post Office Box 18946. And that's Anaheim, spelled A-N-A-H-E-I-M, California. And the zip code is 92817. And if you have not had an opportunity to review this document, I urge you to send away for a copy or go to your library where you should be able to find a copy. But in terms of the time you would spend in terms of doing research, we would be glad to send it gratis, no charge. I will say this, however, the postage for this document and the related material is approximately $2. So if members of the listening audience could afford to send $2, we would really appreciate that. But they're under no obligation to make a donation or contribution to our program.
All right. Do you have a website at all?
Well, we do have a website which is for primarily information, and I apologize, I should update some of the material, but if you have not reviewed it, please do so. It's www.worldstrategy.netfirms, there has to be an S at the end, .com.
One more time, World Strategy.
worldstrategy.netfirms.com.
Netfirms?
Yes.
F-I-R-M?
Yes.
Yes, netfirms.com.
Yes.
Okay, fine. And, of course, what is your radio program in Southern California? If we have some listeners down there, maybe they will start listening.
Oh, thank you for reminding me. We are on every Sunday evening on KPLS, which is 8:30 on the AM dial, serving most of Southern California and points beyond. That's 9 p.m. every Sunday evening. The name of the program is Sound Off with John W. Spring. I generally begin with a brief commentary. I try to have a guest, and I've been fortunate enough on a few occasions to even have Dr. Stan, and then we open the lines to callers. And from my perspective, I would say the callers are generate the most interesting part of the program.
Yes, I always enjoy the when we do an open line program, and of course, you have to have something to say so that they'll have something to respond to. But
yes.
That is loads of fun.
Yes, we very seldom have had really what you would refer to as open lines, but most of the questions are focused primarily on the guest and his or her topic.
Okay, fine. Well, it's a fascinating program. If you have a chance to tune in to John there on Sunday evening, is that 8 or 8:30?
It's 8:30 on the AM dial at 9 p.m.
8:30 at 9 p.m., so I recommend it to you. And John's doing a great job of trying to get the people down there in Los Angeles educated. But you see, we're not going to change anything at all until people know there's a problem. And, of course, there's certain people who know there's a problem. They listen to our programs. It's up to you out there in the listening audience just to go to others and say, look, why don't you listen in? Are you concerned about what's happening to America economically? Have you ever thought what would happen if we had a financial crisis and the value of the American dollar were destroyed? Well, do you think you ought to just consider that as a possibility? Because, of course, the people of Argentina didn't think it could happen there, but it did a couple of years ago. And you realize that those people who had worked so hard for so many years lost two-thirds of the value of everything they had overnight.
Yeah.
Just raise those questions in their minds and then get them onto our programs and let me do the convincing. John, we're out of time. Do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners?
Well, regarding what you just said, actually we no longer have money, but rather we have fiat currency, which has an artificial value placed upon it by the Federal Reserve. And I would urge everyone to take advantage of our offer for document 7277. Again, my mailing address is John W. Spring, P.O. Box 18946, Anaheim, California, 92817. And Dr. Stan, the Lord bless you for the wonderful service you're providing for our nation and for our state. And I just hope that you will continue on the air for many more years.
As long as God gives me breath, I'll be here. And God bless you. Thanks so much for coming on short notice. And we'll look forward to having you as our guest tomorrow, I mean next week, at the same time slot.
I look forward to that. Thank you so much, right, Dr.
Bye-bye. Okay, fine. That was John Spring, and I hope you enjoyed John. I always do. And, of course, this is the time I have to remind you, Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and quite frankly, we need your help and finance to continue doing what we're doing as we reach out across America, across the world, with the truth that you're not going to get elsewhere. So if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Pray for America. Pray for our leaders and for our ministers. But pray for revival. Because if we do not, of course, get the American people away from the apostasy which is gripping our nation, we don't let them understand there is an organized effort to change the message and the music and, of course, the method of our churches. If we don't turn people back to God, why, we will never regain our freedom. And lastly, we ask you to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. And so until tomorrow evening at the same time, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.